Hello, everybody. How's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing really well. How are you, Wes?
I'm doing pretty good myself. Getting ready for a busy weekend of community theater play stuff, but should be fun, if not a little hectic.
They always are.
Yes, yes. But hopefully, you know, some time for gaming in there. I always manage to find time for gaming. But what have you been playing over the past week? I'm curious to hear. Or what do you got in the backlog still?
Yeah, I'm going to do one that's in the backlog. I have actually found a game that I'm like kind of hooked on right now. And I'm playing it a lot. So cool. I think I'll be playing that one for a while, but I'll talk about it next time. There's one other game in my unplayed games list I want to talk about quick. I only played it for like 2 hours because I just wasn't feeling it, but it's a point-and-click adventure game, and man, it's been a long time since I played one of those.
Yeah.
It's got to have been since like elementary school with like Pajama Sam or something.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. So I didn't know what to expect. I didn't even know what game it was. I kind of just picked it from the list and was like, whatever this is, I'm just going to do it, you know? Otherwise, they're just going to sit there being unplayed, so... The game is called Broken Age, and it's a point-and-click adventure game where I think one of the main mechanics is that there's kind of two stories and two main characters, and you can switch between them at any time.
Oh, right, right.
And somehow they kind of weave their stories together by the end. But I started with, there's like a girl that you play and then a guy. And I started with the girl, and I didn't really play her very much. I went over to the guy, and I played most of my session on his story. And first of all, I want to say the art style is beautiful. It's almost like claymation or something. I don't really know what you would call it, but maybe all hand-drawn. It's very cool art style, and that part's about it is amazing. But the gameplay itself, I was very confused about, and I don't know if this is just what point... and click adventure games are. I don't remember kind of playing one. Like, it's been so long. So the main kind of gameplay of this game is there's a pretty big open area of the game, lots of different screens. You're on a spaceship in this case, and you go throughout the spaceship and you just collect like random items that you're finding around the ship by just clicking on them. And then eventually you kind of get to a part that you can't pass and you have to have the right items in your inventory to then pass them. And that kind of reminded me of a text adventure from 1981.
Yeah.
So I had a bunch of items in my inventory by the time I kind of got to that first puzzle. And by the time I got there, I used some of the items and I got through the first puzzle. I got to the second puzzle and I didn't have the items I needed. And I was like, well, do I want to search the whole ship again for this one item I left somewhere? I kind of don't. So I was kind of done with that at that point. And it's a little sad because I think that like the game has great reviews on Steam. I think it's pretty beloved for its story and art style, but the story was too slow. Like, I just didn't care about the characters in the beginning. I think it's one of these kind of games where they want the whole plot of it to be very mysterious, you know, kind of like
right.
You're exploring the world and you're not quite sure what's going on or what the main plot might be. So it kind of leaves the beginning very open and doesn't really tell you anything. And I could see that paying off later if you get later. But for me, it was just like, well, I don't know anything about this world, so I'm not invested in it at all because it didn't tell me anything. So like even one of the first puzzles, it was like, the guy I was playing had like a daily routine, and I think I could have just played his daily routine forever. I had to like break the cycle, you know, if you will, to like progress, which I assume you would do like no matter what eventually, just because you've done everything so many times. But it's like, yeah, the very first thing I want to do when I start a brand new game is play the same like one day over and over again until I figure out what to do. It's like, I don't want to do that. So, yeah, I wasn't really about it, but it was interesting. Some of the puzzles were weird. Like, the game's art style, or not art style, but, like, theming is kind of, I would almost say it's, like, dreamified. So, like, in this case, the guy I was playing, like a lot of the ship components and stuff were like kids' toys. So like okay. at one point I had to get a whipped cream gun, and I ended up attaching that to my spacesuit as a jetpack. And I'm like, okay, I can see the logic, I guess, but like, I don't think a whipped cream gun will actually propel you in space very much. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Like, it just felt weird. Or like, my spacesuit needed oxygen. So my guy had an air pump in his backpack. And so he just took the air pump out of the backpack and like connected it to the space helmet. And now he can breathe in space. I'm like, I don't even know that the space helmet had like a hole for you to do that. It looks like a, you know, a glass bowl to me. So the logic was pretty strange.
Yeah. It seems like, and from what I know of it, cause I haven't played it, but I've heard of it. You know, it's a very fantastical kind of world. And yeah, if you're having trouble buying into that, or it's not pulling you into that world enough, I could see where it's just kind of like, this is weird and confusing, and I'm not that interested, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Like, if it's, like, if you are looking to play point and click adventure games, like, is this what the genre is? I kind of,
from what I've played, yes.
Thinking, yeah. I don't know why. I thought point and click adventure games, maybe I'm getting confused with like spot the difference games, or just games that have like a lot of different mini games, or maybe some dialogue mystery or something. I don't know. But there wasn't really any dialogue in this one. There was voice acting for when there was, but like, again, the game was purposely being very cryptic. So
right.
It was hard to kind of understand what to do next and why. So not that I, you know, had trouble getting through the first few puzzles, but I just wasn't really motivated to continue. So I'm going to put that one down. And I, like I said, I moved on to something else I've been playing a lot. So I'll tell you about that next time. But what have you been up to, Wes? You've had some new games for your birthday, right? You still playing those?
Yes. Well, yeah, I'm still playing Harvestella a bunch. Still haven't really got into Traveler's Rest, the one you got me yet. But another friend of mine bought me a game that he's been trying to get me to play for, I think, literally a year. And I kept saying, nah, it doesn't look that good. But it turns out it's actually pretty fun. It's called Clone Drone in the Danger Zone. And
okay.
There's a single player and a multiplayer aspect to it. The single player actually kind of tells like a campaign of this intergalactic race of robots that are killing humans, then uploading their brains to robots and making them fight for sport. And this is all like pixel graphics, kind of like it's 3D, but everything's like chunky and pixelated. And so there's a single player where you kind of play as one of the humans in one of these robots, which has more to it than I thought it would. So I was really happy about that. But then the multiplayer, you can just do endless arena fight waves. And it's actually pretty fun. I mean, you don't have like a health bar in this game. Your robot has vital points, basically, like the head or the chest. And if those get hit a certain amount of time, you're dead. But like, you can have a leg chopped off and then you're hopping around with one leg, and you can have an arm chopped off and you can only use certain weapons. So there's some really interesting interactions there. And the way that you attack the enemy robots also works like that. For instance, there's this one recurring robot enemy called the Spidertron, which just has these four legs and it's like way high up off the ground. And if you don't have a ranged weapon, you can beat them just by chopping their legs off so that they fall to the ground and then attacking them. So there's some fun physics-based stuff in the game. And each round that you win, you get to upgrade your character so you can do stuff like the hammer, which was my favorite weapon. You can just make it bigger, like three times the upgrade is just make the hammer bigger, and it gets ridiculous and set stuff on fire. There's bows. There's a kick that you can do in a jetpack. So there's a lot of fun stuff. And we were having fun doing a three-player multiplayer match with that and just going mayhem on all the droids and seeing how long we could last for. So that's a lot of fun. There's some unique challenges in it. My main thing, and we'll see, this is why I was naysaying the game before I even bought it, is it seems like that's kind of the whole gimmick. You know, like your robot's in an arena. Once you get all the upgrades, I don't know if there's that much more to do. Right. That being said, that part of the gameplay is really fun, and I was very pleasantly surprised that the single player doesn't just take place like in the arena. Like, I figured it was just going to be like a gladiator style story, you know, but it actually goes to some really cool places just in the four intro chapters that I've played so far. So that was a really nice surprise. Still, as fun as it is, I'm not sure how much longer I'll be playing it, but it's definitely worth looking at, even if you don't buy it, just because it's got funny visuals. The narrators are all basically like Microsoft Sam text-to-speech, so their intonation is hilarious as they're talking about all the stuff when you're going into these arena matches. So yeah, it's pretty good, and it's a really weird game. I love it.
Yeah, the art style reminds me of like Bionicles or something. Not quite Lego, like a little bit more detail, but...
Yeah, and you can actually see the damage when it happens on like that pixelated thing. Like if I get stabbed by a spear, there'll be a hole in my character's chest. So definitely has some nice attention to detail there.
Oh, that was cool. Pretty different.
Yeah, for sure. But I am curious to talk about our special topic for today. It sounds like we might have some new Commodore computers to mention.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about the PET 8000 and then the PET 9000, otherwise known as the Super PET. These computers don't come out till a little bit later in 81. I think the 8000 comes out in May. I saw that somewhere, but we have a kind of computer-centric episode today, so I thought it'd be good to talk about them, and they're not going to, unfortunately, make like a huge splash like something right. like a new computer might. So basically, I'm going to talk about the Commodore PET 8000 series. As I mentioned, I think it comes out in May of 81. It's primarily meant for small businesses, so not great for us, but it's basically an expanded version of a Commodore PET, and it did have some interesting features to it. One of the main things that I really kind of was pushing is that there's a better resolution for the display. The old normal Commodore PET had a 40 by 25 display, which is so bad. And then the Commodore PET 8000 has an 80 by 25 display. It's like twice as many pixels, only in one of the directions. So, and to accommodate that, it was also sold with like a built-in monitor, and that monitor was bigger than the old PET as well. So twice the resolution. Okay, I'm kind of down with that. Something else that it has a lot of that I think is pretty impressive. It came standard with 32 kilobytes of RAM, which for this day and age is pretty good. I would say,
yeah,
like there's some new computers coming out with like 4 kilobytes of RAM somehow, but I would say probably like a normal computer at this time is maybe 16. So it's already twice the normal, and it can be expanded up to, I think, 96 kilobytes of RAM. So that's a lot of RAM. That's a lot of power. To help with all this power, the inside was really weird too. It was like it had the usual Commodore PET motherboard, which was then plugged into a secondary motherboard, all in this one system. I've never heard of that happening before. I don't know how common that is, but it was pretty weird. But it seems cool. So all that stuff is good enough, you know, like there's no new progress on like the sound channels or it being in color, which is kind of annoying. But why didn't this catch on? The reason is because of incompatibility with the old Commodore PET. Because of the new resolution, it wasn't just the fact like old programs looked different, like, you know, like all the numerals were wider or something. It was a fact like it couldn't display like a 40 by 25. And people could not get old programs running on this new PET. Like there was no compatibility between them. People eventually figured out a way to force the Commodore 8000 to display in 40 by 25 resolution so that these programs would run. But if you think about it, like that's like the main feature being like, yeah, we're not using it. And basically what it did, it added these huge black borders on the edges. So it was like, yeah, we're just basically doing, you know, using an old PET now. So that was a big factor. Also, it couldn't run CPM, which was it's like a programming language like BASIC that was very popular at this time. And it couldn't run that. So like the hobbyists were not into this computer. I think it was really only sold and bought by businesses for math related functions and stuff like that. So unfortunately, you know, I think there are some games that are for it, but it's so few. Like, none of my sources have a separate section for the Commodore 8000. It's all just considered part of the Commodore PET line, because I guess, you know, the amount, like what the type of BASIC that they're using, and like the microchip's pretty much the same. They're using a 6502. So it's pretty much just a Commodore PET. If anything, maybe we'll see some games that have better resolutions on them, but I don't think we're really going to see too much from this upgrade. So that's pretty much the 8000. I do want to say quick, it never really took off in the US because of these incompatibility issues, but it did sell pretty well in the EU. So I don't know how that is going to affect us, but it might. So with that being said, though, Wes, Commodore tried to one-up this one also in 81 with another computer. So why don't you talk about the Super PET?
Yeah, so the Super PET, as the name implies, is still part of the PET lineage. It's also called the Commodore 9000. And I think this basically ends up being the last iteration of the PET system, for better or for worse.
They do have the VIC-20 out, so it's like,
yes,
what are they doing?
Yeah, and this, I mean, similar to the 8000, it's really not designed to be an all-round computer like the PET was. This is very specialized, and it was also in the EU called the micro mainframe computer, because that's basically what it was trying to be. It was designed by the University of Waterloo in Canada, and the main reason they wanted to make this is to help teach programming with it. It was kind of created to bridge the gap between a mainframe and a microcomputer. I think the head of computer science at the University of Waterloo said that they had so many people running programs on their mainframe that it was really slowing things down, and they couldn't run those programs on a microcomputer because the microcomputers weren't sophisticated enough. So they're basically just like, well, why don't we make something that fixes the problem? Yep. So then they went for and created the Super PET, which was powerful enough to help run some of the programs that were being run on the mainframe, so it wasn't clogging that up so much. And it also was economical, in quotes, at least comparatively, to buying a mainframe and, you know, more powerful than a microcomputer. It was based on the Commodore 8000 hardware, and there was actually an upgrade pack that was sold to make 8000s into Super PETs. So a lot of what Ben mentioned is pretty similar for the Super PET as well. One of the big improvements it had, though, is that in addition to the standard MOS 6502 CPU, it also had a Motorola 6809 CPU. Again, I'm not too sure how that works, having two CPUs. It sounds like it kind of switched between them for different tasks. Mm-hmm. And instead of the 32K RAM, it had 96K. So this is really...
Okay, so it was like the beefed up version.
Yes, yes. Much more meant for like writing huge programs, storing a lot of data. And since it was, the idea was to use this to help teach programming, it came with BASIC on it, but then also could run a bunch of other languages and had a bunch of other interpreters on it that you could run through floppy disk. And the ones they mentioned specifically were APL, COBOL, Fortran, and Pascal, which are all pretty big languages at this point. And so with the editing that you could do on this computer and the creating of programs, apparently this was one of the first computers to have what's called an RS-232 cable connection, which is a recommended standard 232 cable. And it's a pretty standard cable used to transmit data. And you could actually plug the Super PET directly into a mainframe to transfer like programs and stuff over it, which seems bizarre, but I guess that was a lot easier than if you didn't have a local intranet at your university, or maybe, I don't know, transferring relatively big files over an intranet didn't work very well back in 81. I'm not too sure. But either way, it seems like this was another selling point of the Super PET. But it's really specifically meant for like people who want to teach programming. I mean, I think in 1981, it retailed for $2,700, which is a lot of money. It's definitely straddling the line between a microcomputer and a mainframe there. And one of the other cool features that I wanted to mention is that it also had a built-in text editor, which I guess would be sort of like a word processing software, except for a little bit simpler, but I could be wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of it for the Super Pet. It's the fully beefed up version of the Pet. It's just that none of that stuff that is making it more powerful is really going to do much for us gaming-wise. And I think because it's based on the Commodore 8000, the same compatibility issues apply here, too.
Right. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see much of an impact from these, but that's okay because I'm fully prepared to play a lot more VIC-20 games, which is their new line Commodore has that we mentioned towards the end of last year, I think. And that line is in full color, so I'll take that over the Pets just being in green any day.
Yeah.
All right, but with that being said, though, Wes, let's move on to the timeline. We'll play some of these computer games.
All right.
Hello and welcome back. To start it off today, let's talk about some quick honorable mentions. We've got one here called Centurion by Robert Zeidel and published through APX. And APX is actually Atari's like user software program. We're definitely going to have a special topic on that sometime. But this is for the Atari 8-bit home computer. And it looked pretty interesting. I thought about playing it, but the graphics just aren't there. But it's a strategy game with very simple graphics, like the units are just like letters and stuff. But it is played in semi-real time with fast turn-taking, and you control 10 units of varying strengths and need to move them around into good positions against the enemy. Not quite a real-time strategy, but close, but I thought that was kind of cool.
Hmm.
Definitely worth mentioning.
Yeah, definitely sounds interesting. And we have another Atari 8-bit mention here. It's Galactic Quest by Crystalware, and it's actually a port of the Apple II version, but it did have different combat, and it has color visuals. It looks like it's a pretty nice upgrade, but we only have screenshots of it, unfortunately, and we couldn't find a playable version.
All right, but let's move on to the first one I reviewed today. It's called Voyage of the Valkyrie, and it's by Leo Christofferson.
Oh, yeah.
We've talked about several times. he made Dueling Droids and Robot Nim. And many others, or Android Nim, I should say. He's known for doing TRS-80 games and doing amazing graphics on the TRS-80. And when I say amazing graphics, I mean relatively.
Right.
The TRS-80 can't do any kind of amazing graphics. But this one's a very interesting one because it's his unique style, but the gameplay is actually a lot more deep than almost every one of his other games. I think the gameplay is best kind of summed up, it's kind of like on the Atari 8-bit, I played a game called Star Raiders, which was a first-person turret gunning game, but it also had elements of the old Star Trek games where you would kind of go from quadrant to quadrant clearing stuff out. And in this game, it's similar, where you are, in this case, I think you're piloting like a Valkyrie, which I think is like a Norse flying ship, I want to say. And you're kind of flying through a huge map, going from quadrant to quadrant, and you're shooting down these like harpy looking things when they come up, and you do that by going into like a turret gunning mode. You hit enter on the keyboard and then a crosshair pops up, and you move the crosshair around by moving the arrow keys around. It's not like in most turret gunning games where I think the turret gun is supposed to feel like the whole camera is moving, right? And you're trying to line it up and right in the middle of the shot. In this case, it's really, you're like, there's a crosshair on screen and you can shoot in the upper left corner and the camera's not going to pan to the upper left corner. You're just like shooting at the corner. So it's a little different. While you're shooting down these like harpy looking things, I think they're all like different kinds of birds, like they're condors and stuff, but I'm not quite sure. There's some sort of like Norse mythology going on that I'm not totally sure what exactly these things are called. But
Valkyries are definitely like warriors with wings, so I don't know if that's what's going on, but it sounds confusing.
Yeah, it might be like Leo Christopherson's like imagination of what is it, you know, but it's kind of weird. The harpies are, I think you're shooting down, I'm going to call them the enemy's condors, because I know at least some of them are called condors, but there's a lot of different types, but you know, they're basically big birds. When you're shooting them down, they will actually be defending bases sometimes. And these bases look like castles, like a Neuschwanstein or something like that, like some sort of fantasy castle on a cliff.
Yeah.
As you're shooting them down, first of all, you can fire very quickly in this, pretty much as fast as you want, but whenever you fire, it takes some of your energy down. Also, when you get hit by the enemies, it takes your energy down. If it ever gets to zero, then you die, and you have to start the whole thing over again. But luckily, at any time, you can essentially retreat from a battle, and when you go back into the battle again, it'll kind of start up slowly again. So maybe when you retreated, there were four enemies on screen. But when you go back in, it'll just be kind of one, and then the second one spawns, and then the third one. So you get an advantage, essentially. So you can kind of keep retreating and coming back into the battle a bunch of times to slowly whittle away the defenses. And this is like a mandatory mechanic, I should say, because it's like, the game's very hard. So you do that a bunch of times. Whenever your shields go down, or your energy goes down from firing or from getting hit, and you exit the battle, that bit of energy that was spent gets replaced with this overall energy counter that's like your overall life force or something. That can only be replenished at a base. So you have to make sure you take a base before that goes down the whole way. So you can't constantly be retreating forever. Like, eventually you will lose all of your energy, but you can do it many times. Also, whenever you retreat from a battle, you have the option of demanding surrender of the base. And although I tried to do that every time I retreated, they always said no. But if they say yes, I believe you can refuel at that base at that point, but you don't get gold, which is basically this game's way of saying high score. So you don't get as much high score if you do that. Other than that, the game is kind of in this, I don't know how large the grid is, but it's a very large grid. I'll say it's like 20 by 20, I don't know. And you have to fly, like, there's certain paths through this grid. Basically, you're flying in this giant mountain range, and you can't fly into the mountains. You have to only fly through valleys. So, you know, like Leo Christopherson says, you should be mapping, you know, where you have to go in the game, because it'll be the same valleys every time you play, and that'll make things go quicker and, you know, have it be less likely that you'll fly into a cliff face and die, which happened to me many times.
Oh, no.
The game's not in real time, but I just wasn't aware of the mechanics fully, so I don't think I would continue to do that. But the game is displayed pretty well. Like, there's graphics of the enemy birds, even though there's like 9 different types of enemies. I think they all look like the same identical birds, so I don't know how you would know. Like, also, all the bases have, like, their own names and stuff. But I don't know that you would know the difference with that. But it does look good. You can tell where there's mountains. You can tell where there's valleys. Basically, the game is pretty much turn-based when you're not in combat. And it's just, like, a view of what's in front of you. And at that point, if it's a mountain range, you just turn. And if there's another mountain range on that side, you just turn again, you know. And you can figure your way through the world. But there's a lot of different like little mechanics going on here that's a lot more complicated than most of his other games. And I think it's kind of cool. It's pretty far removed, I feel like, from Star Trek, which is kind of the only other game that I've really seen do this with this whole like Norwegian theme. It's very refreshing. Like, we haven't played any game like it. So it was a good one to take a look at. But was it good? Let's get into the ratings. For gameplay, I mean, if it is good, it would be here on the TRS-80. I did give it a 3.0 out of 10, because I thought it was pretty fun. I ended up going back and playing it even when I thought I was done, because I read the manual a little bit more and was like, oh, okay, so that's how that mechanic works. I'm going to go back and play it again, even though I didn't need to. And I had fun. I was making progress. I was getting better, understanding the mechanics better, and kind of learning which directions I should take in the world and not running into the mountains so much. So I felt like I was getting better with it. I did play on difficulty 0 out of 9. So
oh no.
The game can get brutally hard. But at level 0, I thought, okay, this is a decent challenge, but I'm surviving. I ended up dying in that on that playthrough because I actually took a base and then I thought I had to refuel at the base, you know, get my shields back. And so I tried to fly into the base thinking I would like rest there, and it said, you know, you hit the walls of the base, you die. Oh. Go. Guess that wasn't it. But you know, I was kind of enjoying it. For being on the TRS-80, I think it runs pretty well. Like, it's not a great frame rate, but I'm gonna say we're at like a solid 15 frames a second, which on the TRS-80 is not bad for like a kind of real-time game when the combat's happening. So that part was cool. I felt like when I fired, that was very fast. I could fire faster than the enemies moved. So it was like I was firing at 30 frames a second, if that makes sense. So that was kind of interesting. And just overall, I was like enjoying all the mechanics that it kind of had in this game. So I thought it did a good job, maybe not of explaining what's going on in the world, but for getting me to go through the world and make progress on my adventure, it had everything that I needed for that. So the game does come with a 17-page manual, which is big, but it's not huge. So I thought it was a pretty good manual as well. That helped me learn the game better. So I kind of enjoyed it. I gave it a 3 out of 10. For these other ones, though, not so much. For graphics, I just gave it a 1.5 out of 10. I mean, the TRS-80 is just struggling to keep up with these other computers in 1981. And this is in all black and white, and it's very blocky. Luckily, Leo Christopherson, he's got a very unique style, and you can definitely tell, like, these bird enemies, only he could have made them, because they look, you know, so reminiscent of his other work. So that's helping the graphics a little bit, but it just doesn't matter when they're so blocky, and it's black and white, and it's just the frame rate isn't the best. So I just had to give it a 1.5 there. For sound, there's actually sound in this, and there's actually music. There's, I think, a few different musical tunes. I don't know when I put in the music as I record or edit this week's podcast. I don't know if that'll be able to show them all, because like one of them only played when I took a bass and I had to play for like 10 minutes to make that happen. So I don't know if I'll be able to do that again. But there's a number of different musical tunes. But when you're playing the game, there's like nothing happening. There's no sound. So I liked the music. I wasn't expecting it, but the rest of the game being silent is not too good. I ended up going with a 1.25 out of 10 for sound for that reason. For relevance, I gave it a 6.5 out of 10 because, like, Leo Christopherson pretty much has a cult that follows him, and everybody loves this guy in his games. He's, like, one of the most advertised people in all the magazines. Like, whenever a new magazine pops up, they're like, we got an interview with Leo Christopherson, so pay attention to us. You know what I mean? Like, people love this guy, so I'm sure they would have played this game, and I think it's a very cool game, a very unique one for the TRS-80. I don't think there's anything quite like it. So even though I have seen it kind of in Star Raiders on the Atari 8-bit, on the TRS-80, there's nothing like this. So I definitely wanted to give a little bit of points for relevance. And overall, I give it a 2 out of 10. It's good for the TRS-80, but it is not good when you look at the Apple II or what the Atari 8-bit is doing right now. The graphics are just too old. Like, the TRS-80, it's really struggling to keep up with these arcade machines and everything else that's coming out. But I think the mechanics are pretty complicated. Like, there's depth there, and it's enjoyable. So, for that reason, I had to give it some points in gameplay, and that bumped up the score higher than most TRS-80 games, I would say. So, that was Voyage of the Valkyrie. Nice. It was also published by SAM Software, and I think is eventually going to get published by, like, everybody. So, it's going to be distributed pretty widely, I think.
You know, that's interesting, because I feel like it's the first time we've mentioned, maybe not the first one he's ever made, but the first time Leo Christofferson's made, like, a full-fledged game that isn't just, like, a board game, basically, or, like, a...
Yeah.
Like an animation showcase. Like, he had one, I forget if it was called Devil's Dance or something like that, where it was just like a little devil dancing, and then he had Android Nim, which was just Nim but with funny animations. But this, it's like a full-fledged game. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's the main reason I wanted to check it out. I think the last game he did was one called Dueling Droids. It was a dueling game.
That's right. Yeah.
But even that is very shallow in terms of mechanics, right? But this game is like a whole world is out there to explore and bases to take and stuff. So I thought it was pretty cool. Very unique. A lot more going on. So definitely wanted to mention it. It might be one of the best TRS-80 games ever. Who knows? Because I don't know how much longer TRS-80 is going to be around.
Yeah.
Now that the Coco's out, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we just have to hope that Leo jumps ship onto... another computer or something, because he's definitely proven he can do good stuff even with not great hardware.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Now I've got to review another computer game to take a look at that actually came out on the Apple II, Atari 8-bit, TRS-80, and Coco, but I'm going to be covering the Apple II version, and it is a graphical text adventure called Other Venture Number 2, The Curse of Crowley Manor by Adventure International. And you know it's got to be a good one if we're taking a look at another graphical text adventure, and this one is pretty cool. I do want to mention that we have seen some 1982 dates for this version with graphics, but we're going to go with 1981 because there's a copyright of 1981 that we've seen, and we don't have any firm dates saying otherwise.
Yeah, I think it says it when you launch the game.
It does.
That's not always like the most accurate thing, I think. Voyage of the Valkyrie says 1980 when you launch it.
Right.
So maybe it's not the best indication, but that's the best one we had.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll just go with that. And I mean, either way, as cool as it is, it's graphical text adventure for the Apple II. So it's not like it's totally going to be changing anything if it's coming out in 1981 instead. Other Venture 1, I just want to mention, was actually a port of the original Adventure. So there's not really too much to talk about there. And the Other Venture, like, title series was apparently used to help differentiate Adventure International's other games from the ones that were by Scott Adams. So this was a separate thing. It was made by a guy named Jim Pearson. So they wanted to differentiate it from the Scott Adams ones. And so, as I mentioned, this is a text adventure with graphics for the Apple II, but instead of like we've seen before with some of the Sierra graphical text adventure games, it doesn't have the image always at the top of the screen. It actually has a button, the enter button, where you can flip in between the image and the text describing the room. So it took a little bit to get used to, but it does mean that they get to use the full screen for the image whenever they show the image, which is really nice.
That reminds me, I don't think we've covered a full graphical text adventure that hasn't been Sierra, have we?
I don't think so. No. Yeah, I think this...
Other people are finally copying it.
Yeah, other people are finally getting it. And, you know, a color one, too. I feel like we may have covered a black and white one a while ago that was somebody different. But, yes, to see this, and I gotta say, the fidelity and, like, the quality of these images is pretty good compared to the Sierra stuff, which I also love. But, you know, that scorpion and the wizard and the princess didn't really look like a scorpion. But getting into the general gameplay of The Curse of Crowley Manor, It's different from the classic text adventure, thankfully. It's not a collect the treasures game. You're setting out to solve a murder. And it takes place in 1913 London, so it's got some kind of Sherlock Holmes vibes to it. But it gets really weird really fast. It's not your classic Sherlock Holmes case. It does have a classic text parser with the inevitable weird verb choices and strange interactions. And as I mentioned, you can toggle between the image and a text description of the room, but it does do the same thing we've seen in other graphical text adventures where, say, if you see blood on the wall, you can say, look, blood. And then when it goes back to the picture, it'll actually be a close-up image of whatever you're looking at. So it does have lots of those things where you can get a more detailed look by examining items. There are also a few interesting points where the only command you can enter that does anything is wait. And you just kind of watch things unfold scene by scene as you're waiting in like the classic turn-based text adventure style.
It was like a cutscene?
Yes, sort of. It's really interesting. And I don't think we've seen anyone do it before, at least to this extent, because it happens a couple times during the game, including in the final fight where you're told before the fight, there's only one moment when you can strike. So you're just like watching the enemy come towards you and typing wait until the moment the strike comes up.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a neat way to kind of get some like action and engagement and motion in a text adventure. But those are some of the main differences in the gameplay. Other than that, you know, you've seen text adventures before. So let me get into my ratings now to talk about some of the cool stuff this does. For graphics, I'm going to go ahead and give it a 3 out of 10. I think that's the same I gave Wizard and the Princess, but to be honest, this looks better. I think I might have been a little overenthusiastic seeing the first graphical text adventure way back then. But I definitely want to give it at least the same amount of points because it looks, I mean, there's still some things that look kind of weird, but the quality of the images is so much better. I mean, it's still in kind of the strange Apple II color scheme, but that does give at least like 5 or 6 colors that they could do. You start out in an office, and if you look out the window, you can see a nighttime skyscape of London, which looks pretty cool. Everything from like first-person perspective when you're sitting in the back of a horse-drawn carriage. So they did a pretty good job with all the details, and thankfully it draws the images pretty quickly. I'm not going to say it's super fast. I mean, you're still waiting for like 20 to 30 seconds sometimes, depending on how detailed a room is for it to draw, but a lot faster than some other ones we've seen, so I appreciate that. The one complaint I really have about the graphics is that because it's the Apple II color scheme and this is like a murder mystery, it's a real shame there's no reds, because all of the blood in this game is bright pink. It just looks a little strange, but I mean, you know, it doesn't take too long to be like, okay, that's what blood looks like. That's fine. Moving on to sounds, believe it or not, there are sounds in this game. Apple II can do sound. We've seen that before, but seeing it in a graphical text adventure, that's like almost the full package. I'm not going to say they're great, so I only gave it a 1 out of 10, but I think the way they spaced it out was good. They're so sparse, and it's only like this beeping, buzzy, staticky noise. But when it did happen, it was when I released a mysterious brown growth that I had found into a room full of food, and it started to grow in size every single turn and eventually killed me. And the sound, because I had no idea it was coming, like legitimately scared me. So I think it served its purpose really well. It was just like a beeping noise. And then the screen went like a whole bunch of characters and numbers went on it. Like it looked all staticky. So it was a fun way to be like, oh God, something mysterious and weird is happening. So, you know, not fantastic sounds, but I think it served its purpose really well. And moving on to the gameplay, this is where I feel like a lot of text adventures fall apart, but Curse of Crawley Manor still does a pretty good job of making this much more interesting than a, you know, classic treasure hunt kind of game. So I gave it a 2.75 out of 10. It, of course, is still plagued with some hard to figure out parser verbs. And, you know, I had to look at guides to kind of figure out what commands to even enter half the time. I don't know if you're even told about the wait command, which, as I mentioned, is kind of pivotal to the game. So there's definitely a little bit of weirdness there. But overall, it just felt like a refreshing change of pace for text adventures to be, you know, we've seen interactive fiction games, and then we've seen treasure hunt text adventures, but this fell somewhere in the middle where you're kind of solving this growing mystery that quickly turns from investigating a murder to trying to slay a demon with a magical sword. So it really runs the full gamut of cliches and things that we've seen, and it's its own unique feel, which I really liked. And it really felt like you're playing a story as well, instead of just a mishmash of different themed rooms slammed together. So I enjoyed that. And honestly, I think my favorite gameplay moment, even though it's almost like the absence of gameplay, is the fact that you could type wait and then you like kind of get a cutscene. It was pretty cool. In the final fight with the demon, you're told there's one time when you can strike him and you have to wait until he's right up in your face and then you stab him. And that's pretty satisfying. So I really enjoyed that. And also, it's a pretty short text adventure, which I like, because I think a lot of them are just going for scale right now. And man, I don't have the time to get through them. But this, I feel like, was actually pretty easy to go through in like one sitting. For relevance, I gave it a 6 out of 10. I think it might be the first, if not, it's one of the first Adventure International graphical text adventures. I'm pretty sure. And that's really exciting because Adventure International, of course, is making tons of these text adventure games. So if they're getting into graphical text adventures and seeing popularity with them, hopefully that's going to mean there's a lot more of them. And also, you know, this story style has been done before, but it is great to see a big company doing something other than a treasure hunt. And so overall, that left me with a 2.5 out of 10. I think Other Venture 2 was a pretty fun time. The visuals helped sell the mood and made for some interesting interactions. I loved the wacky theming. And like I mentioned, I also really appreciated it was a short game. Even though I didn't make it all the way through it, I feel like you could beat it in 30 minutes to an hour without too much rushing, which is great. I think that's kind of the perfect time frame for one of these games. And yeah, that is Other Venture 2, Curse of Crowley Manor.
Sweet. Yeah, I think we are going to see quite a few more of these come out by Adventure International. I know at some point Scott Adams redoes all of his original text adventures in graphics.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know that we'll look at all of them, but I'm sure we'll look at some of them. Interestingly, this one, not by Scott Adams, so he was behind on the trend even in his own company.
Yeah.
All right, but let's move on. We've got some other computer games here. We've got one called Galaxy by Microcomputer Games. Came out on the Apple II, Atari 8-bit, and the PET. It was a Star Trek-type strategy game with simple graphics, but allowed up to 20 players to play at the same time.
Oh, cool.
Cool.
And then we have a big list here of games for the TRS-80 Coco that, unfortunately, were not interesting or we had too little info on to cover them. And this is a big list, so I'm only going to mention a few, but as always, we are going to have this available on our website if you want to look and see all these games. We had things like Laser Command by Spectral Associates, Trek Adventure by Aardvark, Magic Spells by Learning Company, Tanjali by Strawberry Software, and a whole ton more. But again, they weren't anything that we really were interested in covering.
And along the same lines, we've got a big list of Commodore VIC 20 games. I thought it would be fun to talk about the VIC-20 and the Coco separate from all the other computers because they're the new ones and they have actually a lot of games released for them this year. Many that we're going to be covering, but also a lot of duds like in this list. Some of these ones that came out in 1981 for the VIC-20 include stuff like Pac-Man, Gold Rush, a game called like Gallows by Noof Cop, which, as you can imagine, is probably Hangman-related. ports of, like, the Adventure International games and a whole bunch of other stuff. Again, you can find that full list on our website in the sources section. But moving on, we've got Creative Computing. That magazine is still around. It's one of the oldest magazines ever, so as far as gaming goes. There was nothing of note in January, and there'll be nothing of note between March and August, so we won't see them too much this year. In February here, they have a game called Monster Combat, by Lee Chappelle, and it's an RPG with rudimentary combat and graphics, but a vast world to explore, lots of enemies, and good replayability. So all in all, sounds pretty cool. If we could play it, we would, but it's just type in text, so yeah. I can't figure that out.
All right, now we have a couple more honorable mentions here. We have Borg by Sirius Software and Dan Thompson, which is a Berserk clone that actually looked pretty good and was dragon themed, and this is for the Apple II, and it even had primitive kind of digitized speech to help replicate the speech that was in the arcade game. And then we also have Dungeon Quest, The Upper Reaches of Apshai by Automated Simulations, which, as you might guess, is an expansion pack for the Temple of Apshai that we covered before. And it had 4 quests in it. But this came out for the Apple II and the TRS-80. It seems like these versions of them are lost, though, so we'll probably revisit it when it comes out later on other systems.
All right, then we've got Star Clones by Creative Computing. Even though they're their own magazine, they also are pretty much a publishing company and publish stuff outside the magazine, like this game. And it's a collection of 4 different Star Wars-themed games, including a stunt cycle type game where you were like launching a land speeder up of a ramp,
nice.
A Space Invaders type game, a bombing game, and a dodging type game, all themed in like Star Wars like assets, essentially ripped right from the movies. This came out sometime in 81 on the Apple II.
And then we have Zost in Space, which is another game by Jim Pearson and published by Adventure International. Came out for the TRS-80, and it was a Frogger-type game, but it had some story and alternative win conditions, which is kind of interesting. Sometimes screens could have traitors or enemies to destroy or avoid, so it seemed pretty cool, but again, it's just on the TRS-80.
Well, Wes, this next game is also on the TRS-80.
Oh, boy. But is it a good one?
It's a text adventure.
Okay.
So we'll see. It's one that I reviewed, my second review of the day, called Asylum by Frank Core and Med Systems. And Frank Core is the same guy who did Death Maze 5000. He also did a game called Labyrinth that I know we at least did an honorable mention on last year. But to me, this is like the best looking graphical text adventure that we could ever hope for on a TRS-80.
Okay.
So it's on the TRS-80, so it's not in color, but the graphics are actually pretty good. It's kind of in this first person maze perspective, like we've seen in maybe like a Play-Doh game or something, with this wireframe kind of maze wall layout. However, the graphics are much improved because like there's beds in the rooms, there's doors on the doorways. There's like NPCs or, you know, some characters that kind of move between room to room. So it just looks way better than anything we've seen. And this whole series, starting from Death Maze 5000, kind of started in this style where it was like a wireframe maze game, but with some graphical elements. And I feel like Asylum now is kind of stepping it up one level further. And really, the world is feeling a lot more like a real world and less like a maze. So that's good. But it's not in color, so it's not as good as our graphical text adventures like Curse of Crawley Manor. But I definitely wanted to check it out to give Frank Core his props. There's some pretty weird stuff going on in the game, though. Some like, I read the Blue Ranga blog about this, as I usually do for text adventures, and he didn't like it because the game's really hard and kind of just not fair sometimes, but I have to say, some of these scenarios or things that happen in the game, I think are pretty like memorable, and you would remember them for a long time. So a couple just like general things about the game outside just the graphics, as far as what it improved, this game allows you to type in phrases instead of just like a 2-word parse whenever you're typing stuff. So hopefully you can be a little bit more loose, and there's a lot more options with the parser. But again, the Ranga and Blue blog kind of determined that no, it's just like it can still be pretty picky about what it wants. A good example of this is when I was playing, I had to go through a door, and so I kept trying things like pick lock, you know, use pick on lock, pick door, I kept trying to pick this door open, and the correct parse had, you had to have the word unlock in it, which makes sense, but you know, it's like they should have both worked. Come on.
Right.
So it uses phrases though, so I guess that's better. Some of the other interesting mechanics in it, there's a few NPCs in it. They're like pretty much just outlines of people because this is just a black and white game. So if you can imagine, it's kind of just a white outline of somebody, but you can tell like they have a hat on, they've got a weapon on or something. So there's a lot of NPCs in the game, and some of them you can even bribe to follow you and help you in your adventure, and they'll go with you from room to room. So I thought that was pretty cool. Some people that follow you in a text adventure. There's just some kind of ridiculous stuff though in the game. The game is like the story is that you're trapped in an asylum and you have to escape. And I don't know if you being crazy is like part of the story or if it's just like random stuff that's in the text adventure, you know, like, cause we've seen both, you know, we've seen it where it goes from like a basketball court and then you go west and it's like, you're at the bottom of a lake and you're like, what?
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know if it's supposed to be like that, but at one point you pick up like a note. And if you read the note, it says, look up. And if you look up, it says, a piano is falling on your head, you die. That's a way to die in the game. And if that wasn't weird enough, one of the solutions later to the game is there's a murderer chasing you. And the way to defeat the murderer is to give him the note. He reads it and a piano falls on his head. No matter where you are in the maze. And it's like, is this supposed to be like just absurd, you know? But it's pretty funny though. I think you would definitely remember that. There's a lot of weird stuff going on, but I thought it was pretty cool. Like, you know, there's your normal inventory kind of systems. There's you know, kind of fake combat because this is a turn-based text adventure game, but they're trying, you know. One thing that was kind of interesting is that part of the maze is actually in a hexagon shape, which is super weird because, like, as you play through it, those wireframe wall graphics give the illusion that you're always turning in 90-degree intervals, like you're going north, south, east, and west. But the maze is actually organized in a hexagon pattern, so instead of turning 90 degrees, and get in blue blog calculated, you're really turning like 72 degrees, but it doesn't look like that. Like, it looks like you're turning 90. So that made mapping pretty difficult, but I have to say, very unique. You know, I haven't seen that before. So if they can just get the graphics to add it, like, you know, show that you're turning slightly less than 90 degrees, I think it would have been perfect, but it's a little confusing as it is. But I think those are all, like, the main things I have to say about it. So let me get into the ratings. For gameplay, I give it a 2.5 out of 10. It's all right. Like, you know, I'm not a huge text adventure guy and I was struggling even just to open up the first door, but I think there's a lot of cool little things in this game, from having NPCs follow you around to the different like hexagon shaped layout to all the crazy scenarios that you come across and the crazy puzzles. So I kind of thought it was at least memorable. And the fact that you can put in full phrases on the parser made me feel like, okay, maybe that'll be a little easier. I mean, it wasn't that much easier, but I wanted to give it some props for kind of going a little bit above and beyond just a normal text adventure in my mind. It wasn't a collect the treasure, which was great. So it was fun, but, you know, it's not going to be as fun as even my point and click Broken Age adventure game I played this week. It's just a little bit too complicated and still a lot of mapping. The maze was really huge in this, so I wasn't going to be a fan of that. I should say there's one part mechanic I haven't mentioned. I think I did say that there's lots of doors, right, on all the doorways. But if there's a door on every doorway in a giant maze and you get a key, man, that's annoying. Because the key can be for any one of the doors. You're going down, checking all of them. There's got to be 20, 30, 40 doors in the game. So that part's kind of weird. So, you know, I couldn't go too high, but I thought it was all right. For graphics, I gave it a 1.5 out of 10. Certainly not the 3 that Wes had on the Apple II. But I think as far as the TRS-80 goes, this is about as good as it's going to get. A lot of the things that are displayed, like a bed or an NPC or a desk, they're pretty like well detailed. You can tell what they are. We're not going to have the level of detail where you can see like blood on the walls or something. It would just look like three like white dots on the wall. That wouldn't be good. But for these larger kind of creatures or set pieces, they are modeled there. When you open a door, it does look like it becomes open, you know, after you unlock it. So there's a lot of really good animations and graphics in this game, considering it's on a TRS-80. So I had to give it some points there. Unlike sound, though, for sound, there's no sound. So 0 out of 10 there. And we know that the TRS-80 can do sound because Leo Christopherson just made some amazing music on it. So, yeah, sticking with the 0. For relevance, I give it a 6 out of 10. I mean, it's the third one of these games that these guys made, and it's, I think, definitely the best one. So as far as graphics go, certainly, and even I think the story and the kind of concept of it is interesting. So I wanted to give it some points of relevance. I don't know how well it's sold, but it seems to be somewhat popular, certainly more than the average text adventure. And overall, I gave it a 1.25 out of 10. Pretty low score. The sound brings it down a lot, it being completely silent. The gameplay was all right, but, you know, it's still being held back by classic text adventure norms, like the parser not knowing that I wanted to pick a lock versus unlock a lock. And, yeah, it was just all right. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of instant death scenarios. We never like to see them.
Yeah.
So, couldn't go too high with it, but I definitely think it was worth checking out and mentioning because, again, you know, this might be one of the best TRS-80 text adventures that we're going to see. The only one that I think comes close to it, I think I played an Atlantis game that was quite good on the TRS-80.
Right.
That had graphics, but that wasn't in first person. It was more similar to the graphic adventure that you played, Curse of Crawley Manor, where it felt like the graphics on that game were kind of like set going from set piece to set piece and not necessarily like a one-to-one correlation of a hallway that you're walking down. Like in this game, it felt like you were in a single building and you weren't like teleporting down a block once you moved one way or another or something. So it's a little bit different. Yeah, so yeah. It's a pretty unique take on text adventures, right? This kind of first-person maze style that we don't see too often. And then for it to be as good as it is graphically and gameplay-wise, it makes it a pretty good one.
Yeah, cool. Definitely an interesting take on the genre and very unique, if you can say nothing else about it. Like, I don't think we've seen anything that's just like this.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, now let's move on with a handheld honorable mention. We have one called Juggling Seal, and it did have, I believe, a Spanish, Japanese, and French release too. I'm not going to butcher the names here, but this was by Bandai, and it was basically a clone of Game & Watch's Fire. So it was a juggling type game, but you play as a seal juggling balls, which is pretty fun. And of course, it had those nice like sprite handheld graphics that we've seen before. And now we have the second game that I reviewed today, which is an arcade game and one of the Deco cassette games, Terranian by Data East. This one we do know for sure came out in February, and it is Deco cassette number 4. For those of you who don't remember, the Deco cassette system was basically a arcade cabinet where you could switch out cassettes to play different games on the arcade cabinet. So very interesting, and thankfully a lot of these games looked pretty cool too. The flyer for Terranian was pretty cool. It first says that you have to defend the planet Terra so that peace isn't shattered. Love that language. And also it quite literally just has a TIE fighter on the front of it. Like, they may have changed one thing to make it look slightly visually distinct, but it is a TIE fighter. And what your ship is looks like it's basically an Enterprise-style Star Trek ship. So maybe slight lack of imagination for some of those, but it still is a good-looking flyer. Unfortunately, we couldn't find any video or images of the original cabinet, but we do have some pretty reliable emulations of it that I was able to play.
I'm not sure if they make, like...
Oh, you're right, yes.
They kind of are from cassettes, so yeah. I don't know if they... Maybe they just send like a new bezel for it, so it just says Turmanian like at the top of it, you know? But I don't think there would be any artwork on the sides of the cabinet.
That's a good point. Forgot about that since it is the interchangeable deco cassette system. Yeah, I would think maybe they would send a marquee or a bezel like you said for it, but not too sure how they advertise these. But for the gameplay, you know, you're in space, you're defending a planet. What could it possibly be? Turanian is a Galaxian-style game. Big surprise. But it does have an interesting twist. You are actually defending the planet that's at the top center of the screen. It has three force fields around it, and the enemies will eventually try to attack it and destroy it. You have enemies that show up from the top of the screen. They come in waves, and it's a different type of enemy per wave. And they don't move in the classic Space Invaders way or really the Galaxian way. They're sort of just slowly moving downwards, but also all over the screen. They're going kind of crazy all the time. and it seems like after a certain amount of time has passed or after the enemies have been on screen for a certain amount of time, some of them will turn into this floating head type enemy that stops attacking you and goes up to Terra, the planet, circles around it, and then after circling a couple times will eventually attack it and destroy one of its three shields. And after all three shields are destroyed, if it gets attacked again, it'll be destroyed. Or also I've seen it happen where like four of the heads were circling at once, and even though there was two shields left, it still instantly destroyed Terra because there were so many of them. And when Terra is destroyed, the game is over. Of course, you're also getting shot at the whole time, and you have, I think, three lives, and you get more lives with more points. The aliens, as I mentioned, are constantly erratically moving across the screen. They do shoot at you occasionally, and they turn into heads eventually. I'm still not sure what triggers that. Your ship fires two parallel lasers at the same time, and you can fire pretty quickly, thankfully. Not as fast as you can mash the button, but more than just one shot on screen at once, which is great. And you also have a really unique secondary attack, which is a missile that you can fire. And you can hit the fire button again to choose when to detonate it. And when it detonates, it explodes into shrapnel that flies in a bunch of different areas and can kill a lot of enemies. So really unique type of attack. And you can only fire one of these missiles before you have to go back to the center of the screen where there's a little missile silo and reload by sitting on top of it for a second, and then you can fire a missile again. And also, after you fire a missile, you can't fire your regular lasers for a short amount of time. After you finish one round, it seems like the game repeats with fairly similar rounds as it goes on. I hadn't really seen any new enemy types worked in, but there may be some eventually. That's basically it for the game, though. Galaxian style game with weird movement and defending a planet at the top of the screen. Let me get into my ratings now. For graphics, I gave it a 4.75 out of 10. It looks really good. I mean, it's great looking Galaxian style game. It's got lots of multicolored sprites, pretty good looking player ship, good explosion animations, even has some rainbow color changing effects on some of the enemies. It made me realize I may have gone a bit overboard when I rated Defender as a 5 out of 10 for graphics last episode. But Defender does have its own charm, so I'm going to stick with that rating. But anyways, Turanian looks fantastic. It has a nice scrolling background as well, with what looks like a nebula in the background and a couple twinkling stars. I also appreciate that the enemies have multiple sprites for when they fly closer to the planet. They like get smaller to make it look like the planet's way in the distance. There's also lots of movement animations too, especially for the bee enemies, which remind me a lot of the bees in Galaga, even though we haven't got there yet. And the bees also turn into fireballs for some reason, which I don't understand, but it looks cool. So I'm down with it. The planet Terra itself also looks good. It basically looks like Earth, you know, blue with green land. It's fairly well detailed and it's constantly spinning. I don't know if... how that works as far as like how fast days are on Terra, but it's spinning very fast. But still, it looks good that you have like this spinning planet in the background. And one of my favorite visual elements is that your ship, you can actually see when you have a missile loaded on it because it just puts this giant missile right in the center of the ship. And it's a different color from the rest of your ship. It's bright red, so it's really easy to see when you have a missile loaded. And it actually moves up from the silo, so also you can tell if the silo has a missile, that means you don't have one, basically. So lots of cool visual elements worked in here, and it all moved pretty smoothly and looked pretty good. For sounds, I gave it a 3 out of 10. For the most part, the game has the classic Galaxian-type sounds that we've heard before. Lots of beeping, some sort of pulsing siren noise in the background, and pretty standard firing and explosion noises. Something nice that it does have, though, is this little song at the start of each new round and every time you start a new game. It's a pretty short tune, but it didn't sound like anything I'd heard before, you know, not just like a weird ripoff classical song or anything. It was pretty unique, so I really liked that, and that it gave Terranean its own feel. Moving on to gameplay, I gave this a 3.75 out of 10. Honestly, as great as it looks, it wasn't as fun as I was hoping it would be. It's a pretty decent playing Galaxian type game, but it definitely has a few issues. Main one for me is, as I mentioned a couple times, the ways the enemies move. They're just all over the place. Like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know if you're supposed to just spam the fire button or what. I didn't really feel like I was aiming most of the time, except when I was trying to take out the heads that were rotating Terra. I also didn't really like the feel of the double lasers. And to be honest, I'm not too sure why, since
whoa,
I know
whoa,
that.
Whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
Since I know that, you know, Galaga is going to be coming out soon, and I like the unlockable double lasers in that. I think part of it for me, though, was that they're, if the enemies went all the way to the side of the screen and to the part where they were like halfway off the side of the screen, you just couldn't hit them at all. Because if you were all the way to the right side of the screen, your lasers were slightly offset. So I thought that was annoying. It seemed like I was missing a lot of shots that way.
Because the two lasers, it's not like the center of your ship.
Yes.
It's not where they're hitting. They're hitting like the sides of your ship.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you aim down the center, you missed everything.
Yes, and that happened to me a lot too, because there's like just a big enough space between the two lasers that you're missing some stuff. So you kind of have to aim off to either side. And you do get used to it eventually, but it was just a little bit weird. On the bright side, though, I think this game did do a lot of unique stuff for gameplay. I like that you have to defend the planet, and aiming for like the heads rotating around the planet is different than the feel of the other gameplay, which is cool. I really like the addition of the missile that you can shoot and detonate and does like shrapnel everywhere. It's cool because it's another thing that it forces you to concentrate on, but it also gives you a bit of like a Hail Mary if you don't really know what else to do. And I think you could get really good with it too, which is nice. So overall, I thought the gameplay was pretty good, but there were some areas where it felt a little bit lacking. For relevance, I only gave it a 4.5 out of 10 here. I mean, there's next to no information about this game. I think the Deco cassette system in general, while it's pretty cool, didn't really hit it off in a big way. So it does do some cool stuff with the missile, but I don't think it was super impactful on other games. And while I liked the gameplay of defending a planet, we have seen similar things done before in other Galaxian games. So overall, that left me with a 3.75 out of 10 for Terranean. It's a great looking Galaxian game, and it had some unique gameplay, a nice musical tune, but all in all, it wasn't really fun enough to like push it over the edge for me. I really did enjoy the wild graphics, but the gameplay just left me wanting a bit more. But it does make me excited. I mean, as we've seen before, the Deco cassette system can do some pretty cool stuff. So I'm really excited to see what other cassettes we get for this. And that is Terranean by Data East. It's pretty cool. Does some cool stuff, but lacking in a few areas.
Nice. Yeah, I think my favorite part of that is just the background.
Yeah.
It's more than just the starry sky. Like, I feel like I can see like galaxies in the background and like nebulas in the background.
Yes, yeah.
I don't know if we've ever seen before. That's really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we only have one other thing to mention today, and that's the next Deco cassette game. It's not one that we were able to play, unfortunately. It's called Missile Sprinter, otherwise known as Missile Splinter by Data East. And it's Deco Cassette number 5, but it was never released and is now lost. But I guess they must have advertised it and pulled it or something, and that's why the, you know, the next game in this series is not number 5, but they just kept the numbers going at 6. So. But yeah, I'm pretty excited about these Deco Cassette games. A graphics rating of, 4.75? I could take some more of those kind of games.
Oh, yeah.
All right, but that is going to do it for us today. So I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We did Voyage of the Valkyrie by Leo Christofferson, The Curse of Crawley Manor by Adventure International, Asylum by Frank Core and Med Systems, and Terranian by Data East. Some pretty good ones. Maybe they didn't score the highest, but even these games that aren't scoring too high, they all have their own unique charm or mechanics to them, and that's the amazing part of 1981. So I'm glad we're here.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great to be in 1981. And if you want to take a look at some of the other games we've played, there was great stuff in the previous years too, just maybe a little bit more sparse. So make sure to check out our website where we have lots of information on everything we've played before. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter where we post updates. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.